Lowe's early Black Friday deals are going fast. Don't miss up to 50% off select major appliances. Plus, up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. And with Christmas around the corner, you're going to need more string lights, right? Save $4 on GE LED 100-count string lights, now just $5.98. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 12/3. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
It's the Wonky Show. The government's going to get Britain working, but what role will HE play in the plans? There are big divides between international and home students in this year's PTES. We'll get across those. And transforming universities. What would it take and how much would it cost? It's all coming up.
When you fast forward a few years, is you then end up with legislation, white papers and so forth, which start to then put more demands from the state of what they get in return for the investment that they pump into you as institutions. And then the ONS turn around and go, well, you're public sector now.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson. I'm here to complain about how cold it is from their respective locations. As usual, three world-class guests. In Whitechapel, Shane Chowan is editor at FE Week. Shane, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week, Jim, I was in Manchester on Friday for the Words Girls UK National Finals. No one knows what Words Girls is. You should definitely look it up. Hugely exciting. Several universities, students and apprentices from several universities won awards in all sorts of skills, from cybersecurity. UCLan won a silver medal in additive manufacturing, and you can check out all the results on FE Week, but it was a really exciting day.
Excellent stuff. Links in the show notes as ever. In Devon, Roscoe Hastings is Director of Teaching Excellence Enhancement at the University of Exeter. Roscoe, your highlight of the week, please.
I got stranded in Bristol in Stormbert, so making it back to Devon in one piece was about as good as this week's been for me.
And in Aldershot this week, Debbie McVitie is Editor at Wonky. Debbie, your highlight of the week, please.
I'm going to take a cheeky double bite of the apple and say on Tuesday I had the pleasure of attending the Independent Higher Education Conference, which was lovely, and shout out to everyone who, the first thing they said when they saw me was, oh, I recognise your voice from the podcast, so hi. And then I had the double pleasure of spending yesterday up at the fabulous Milton Keynes campus of the Open University, having my mind blown in a series of marvellous ways about access and remote STEM delivery and all sorts of other things, some of which I think might actually show up in the conversations that we're going to have today.
Well, we'll see about that. So yes, we start this week with skills. The Westminster government has published a white paper to get Britain working. Debbie, what's in it?
Yep, so in this white paper, there's a sort of fundamental analysis that the various bits of the system aren't joining up properly. And one of the kind of things that is holding Britain back and stopping economic growth and productivity is this very long tail of people who are not in work and have very little prospect of being in work. There's a few different reasons for that going on. So one is about people who are long-term sick, for example. So the white paper is proposing that there be more join-up between health policy and work policy, and thinking about how you support people to stay in work if they're at risk of leaving or kind of come back to work working by the NHS, but also through a sort of local level in that way. There's going to be more devolution. So there's going to be local Get Britain Working plans that will kind of share some of the features of the national plan, but will be kind of rolled out at a local level, and a kind of number of mayoral combined authorities mayors are on record saying what a marvelous idea, and we were already doing this, and what a great, you know, and this is how it's going to work. Particularly, I think for listeners, they'll be interested in the kind of youth focus. So there's a group of young people who leave school without essential skills or any kind of real plan for the next step in work or training or education, and the government's promising a youth guarantee that all 18 to 21 year olds who need it will have access to an appropriate training or work opportunity. And at a sort of macro level, there's going to be more join up between job centres and the existing National Career Service, which is the sort of online provision for people looking. So rather than kind of just saying forcing people to take any old job and kind of, I guess, sort of kind of using the sort of stick to get people into work, it's going to be a bit, hopefully a bit more supportive. I think the real challenge here is this is a white paper, of course, and will be subject to debate. There's been the promise of a little bit of money to go into some trailblazing areas to start testing out different ways to kind of get things moving. But there's a question about how much money is actually available and what real difference it can make. It's about 45 million to be distributed across eight different areas. One last thing that caught my eye that I thought might be quite interesting for universities, because obviously a lot of this is going to be taking, you know, this is going to be sort of further down the pipeline, the education pipeline, as it were. Universities, I think, should take a strong interest in this because it is their pipeline and there's things that they can contribute. But I think universities should be thinking about this in terms of their role as employers as well. And something that caught my eye is that the white paper includes an independent review of the role of UK employers in promoting healthy and inclusive work workplaces. And I think that's quite that's something that universities should be thinking of in the context of the staff they hire. So there's, you know, not exclusively in terms of education opportunities, but what sorts of employment opportunities universities are offering, and how they're supporting their local areas to create those opportunities in partnership with other organisations.
Interesting stuff. Now, rolled up in all of this is reform to the apprenticeship system and the creation of Skills England, and that's been in the other place this week, Shane.
Yeah, it has. So this week saw the conclusion of the committee stage of the IFATE abolition bill, IFATE being the Institute for Apprenticeships and Technical Education. So to catch people up, the government are taking all the powers that IFATE currently have around setting standards for technical education. They're absorbing that into the Department for Education, and then they will decide at a later date which bits of those are going to go into a new executive agency called Skills England. Some noticeable differences between IFATE and Skills England are that IFATE has some level of quasi-independence. It's a non-department public body, right? So it sits outside of the Department for Education, whereas Skills England will be an executive agency. And one of the big criticisms that has come across in the committee stage debates from members of the House of Lords directed towards our Minister, Jackie Smith, is that this new structure of Skills England being essentially an in-house executive agency rather than an independent ear for employers is that this could undermine standards. Damien Hines, the former Shadow Education Secretary, went as far as to say that Skills England was doomed to fail because it would lack that independence. Jackie Smith put up a powerful defence, making the case that under Skills England, the system will be better. Government control is better, was her line, in so many words. Surprise, surprise. And her view is that IFATE wasn't perfect. And if you talk to employees that are involved in technical education and apprenticeships, you know, they will tell you stories about how IFATE does tend to take its time updating, standards when something in industry, develops or enhances and they need to change the training standards. That does take some time. There are hurdles for people to jump through. And Bridget Phillipson, Jackie Smith's point is that their new system under their control could make some of those changes happen quicker.
Yes, yes. DfE being famous for its rapidity of action. Alison Wolfe was involved in the debate. Let's hear a clip.
It seems to me quite extraordinary that at a time when we have a government which recognises the centrality of skills and which is committed, for example, in today's white paper, to a system-wide approach, that we are actually being asked to pass legislation which puts everything inside the department, reporting to a DfE official, so that actually there isn't even a report for other government departments on the face of this bill, never mind for the public at large and for Parliament. I cannot believe that this makes sense in terms of the government's ambitions, expressed ambitions for Skills England, which was that it should be system-wide, that it should do something that went beyond the remit of individual particular agencies and quangos and actually took in the whole scene effectively.
If you look at today's Marshall list, you'll see anytime Skills England's mentioned, it's in quotation marks, as if it's almost like some soiled rag that you need a glove to pick up with and hold it at some distance from your body. I mean, it's astonishing. I mean, why should we be so afraid to say that? We all know what we're talking about here, so let's just be open about it.
Fascinating. Now, Roscoe, obviously there's a kind of backdrop debate about a shift towards tertiary for all sorts of accounting reasons. Further education colleges are now technically public bodies. We should just nationalise universities and put them inside DfE, shouldn't we?
I don't think I can agree with you on that one, Jim. I think institutional autonomy is so important and central to our existence that putting us firmly under the claws of DfE would be probably a step too far. But I think there is a point, and I think Alison Wolfe kind of captured it quite well there, that kind of systems-wide approach that is something we should be looking to move to. I mean, we know, for instance, that in the work that the government has published this week on its white paper, that there is quite a distinct lack of any kind of reference to kind of university or the education end of the DfE, DfE's remit. There's a distinct lack of kind of connection to the work that University Career Services and other career services are doing in this work. So I do think we are missing a trick. I'm just not necessarily sure I'd go as far as nationalising universities.
Yeah, okay. Debbie, this idea of a sort of, tertiary system, where are we? I mean, are we getting closer? And what what does all of this tell us about what the kind of real barriers are?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think we're anywhere near in England. I mean, obviously, but also, I mean, even different parts of the country have a different kind of sense of what they think tertiary is, and I think in Scotland, I suppose, is the kind of closest to a tertiary system, and that is particularly because there is quite strong articulation between college provision and university provision, and I think that's where and of course the idea of being tertiary is a thing that people say because it sounds a bit fashionable and not necessarily something that people have a really kind of strong sense of exactly what that means. So I think we need to kind of say, well, what does this mean for England, and why is that a better way of organising things? As Roscoe said, sort of a bit more systematised, a bit more coordinated. And I think thinking about this in the context of the approach to getting young people into work and training is about thinking what are those kind of, as I heard a vice chancellor refer to it recently, ladders of opportunity. So one of the things that I think policy sometimes doesn't think very hard about, and I think for obvious reasons, because you have to prioritise, is about sort of saying, okay, let's say that we can kind of crack some of those really wicked social challenges that are causing, for the sake of argument, young people, but adults as well, who have low skills, who are stuck in kind of low paid work, to find better opportunities, to find education opportunities, often probably through their local FE college. It's really, really important that if they want to then progress from there, that they are able to do that, and they're not taking a qualification that might get them into a job, but then doesn't offer them kind of future opportunities. So something that is, so thinking at that kind of regional level about what that progression pathway, what that ladder looks like, how these things articulate with each other is quite important. And it's really important for productivity as well, because a lot of the productivity gains kind of come at that higher skill level. So that's where I think thinking in a tertiary way about, start from the kind of perspective of the learner, rather than just saying, right, well, let's just kind of offer this proliferation of various opportunities and everyone's sort of operating independently and trying to talk to employers independently. We can coordinate a little bit. We can build these ladders collectively, and we can help people get from one step to the next. And we're not, we're nowhere near that yet. But there is some really interesting practice emerging, and more could if the government were to give it a bit of a nudge.
If we link this back to the Get Britain Working white paper, I think what this does is expose in a way the failure of the tertiary lobby to really articulate how a tertiary model in England would help to actually solve problems. A lot of the arguments have been through the lens of, institutional sustainability and a little bit around local labour markets. But what I haven't seen is a really strong argument on how, for example, a tertiary model could arrest the increasing NEET rate that we're seeing. And let's not forget that all of this sort of debate over the last 7 days kicked off with decade high levels of 16 to 24 year olds not in education, employment and training. So if you look at the trailblazer models that are being proposed for the mayoral combined authorities, there's lots of different services that have to sit around a table to solve this problem, not just universities, colleges and apprenticeship training providers. And the needs of young people now are far more complex than they were 10 years ago when NEET levels were last this high. So we need to involve other services like the health service, like social services, like mental health services in particular, and housing as well, becoming a huge barrier for young people to get on in life. So I think tertiary is in a way not enough anymore. And there needs to be lots of other people involved in that conversation about providing pathways through education and through work for young people. And I think these trailblazers could be a decent way of having a crack at that.
Yes, that whole question about whose job it is to address all of the layers below self-actualization in Maslow's hierarchy of needs, I was talking about on the site earlier this week. The other question I was going to ask you, Shane, was every time people talk tertiary, the two big elephants in the room are the amount of money that students get and the amount of money that institutions get for different qualifications, and where that money comes from, and whether it's loaned or given out. And, from your end of the tertiary sector, these are huge issues to address, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I don't think I need to rehash for your audience what some of those, massive differences are in, individual funding rates between a course from the adult skills fund, which used to be called the adult education budget, compared to the 16 to 19 funding rate, compared to the, full-time undergraduate funding rate. Those differences have been long publicised and discussed. However, when we look at things like the lifelong learning entitlement, when we look at things like the growth and skills levy, we're staring at these things coming at us in the next couple of years. There does seem to be a lot less of an emphasis on, where that learning learning happens and more on what that learning is. And I do hope that that does continue, because I think that's a healthier way of discussing education policy, but also potentially, you know, start to level that playing field, at least above sort of level three on what those spending disparities are. And we're seeing the consequences of that now. As we record today, 32 sixth form colleges are on strike because teachers in sixth form colleges didn't get the same pay rise as the school teachers did, with that 5.5% over the summer. So there's inequalities everywhere and people are starting to do things about it.
Roscoe, you work at Roscoe Group University that has gone quite head first into degree apprenticeships, but you've also obviously got a whole range of postgraduate taught qualifications, and it strikes me that there's a certain type of kind of learning and a certain type of skills, particularly kind of skills for the professions that exist in PGT qualifications, that are just completely missing from this debate, completely missing from the LLE, and so on and so on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it picks up on Debbie's point around the skills ladders. We've gone quite heavy in our regional skills strategy at the University of Exeter around this concept of skills escalators, and it's precisely that point, Jim, that there are a range of mechanisms and opportunities and offers that we can give to students and employers to meet the varying skills needs that they've got. I think we need to find a way of creating portfolios across the country and across institutions that are reflective of both the demand that students have for the careers of the future, but also the employers within those localities. And I think if we can find ways to better establish those conversations and connections, we'll get there. But without some kind of impetus to do that, and I think that's really what I would like to kind of see the role of Skills England do in the future.
Debbie, one of the things that I keep hearing at conferences is thing about artificial intelligence is it's sort of changing what employers think they need in terms of skills very, very rapidly. And of course, Shane was talking about how slow the systems and structures can be sometimes to recognize that and then put the appropriate qualifications in. The closer education gets to employers and their needs, the harder this gets to maintain and run substantial long-term courses, isn't it?
I think that's nonsense, actually. Having this sort of absolutely fascinating discussion with colleagues at the OU yesterday, because I think that, I mean, there will always be a kind of strand of education that is focused on kind of the specifics of of technology and kind of building technologies, but that's that relates to a set of skills about digital engineering. I don't know what the exact kind of thing, but I think there's something really important about a world in which technology can do a lot of things for you is a world in which you need people who are able to be critical. And I realize, sorry, that's a very academic way of talking about it, but I always kind of fall off my chair laughing when people talk about saying, well, we need to train prompt engineers for generative AI. And I just think that is absolute nonsense. What people need is what they've always needed, which is the ability to look at something and go, well, that's a bit crap.
Please write me an optimistic LinkedIn post about my day.
But you need people who can look at something and go, okay, what's that? That's just been produced by this machine. Is that any good? And that's exactly the sort of same, those are the skill sets. And I think that it is, there will always be a need for people to learn how to do a sort of set of quite well-defined things, but there will also, and I think probably even increasingly, be a need for people to design those things and make judgments about those things and do all the things that the technology can't, which involves, I think where education changes is there's that bit about what humans can do and the kind of human thing. I think where education changes is more about that focus on kind of the whole person and a bit less on the kind of the knowledge and kind of the functional knowledge bit. And what the thing that probably, and again it goes back to ladders of opportunity, what does that look like at every education stage? How do you kind of help people into that space? And I was sort of rambling now, but what the thing that was particularly interesting from the Open University perspective is so much of the work that they're doing is with really, really underserved groups. So you think about people who come from a care experience background, disabled veterans is another one. People who've kind of served their country and come back from the armed forces and have disabilities because else because they've been injured in war environments and are therefore kind of, you know, and that those are exactly the kind of specific groups that you might want something like a work strategy to be looking at. And actually for those people, they're enormous, you know, when they have these opportunities made available to them to do a higher education qualification, and it is a kind of, you know, it is an academic qualification. This is not just sort of, you know, a 6-week cyber skills course. They are enormously successful. But what they need is funding to do that, and the support that comes with you know, being able to do that in an accessible way and in an institution that kind of understands that their very particular needs and is able to kind of accommodate them. So it's not, you know, I think, you know, there'll always be a kind of role for the sort of the, you know, the 12-week cyber skills and God forbid prompt engineering, I don't know, but you know, we're still going to need people to be able to kind of think in deep ways, and I think we shouldn't underestimate the capability in the population as a whole to do that sort of work.
Yeah. Shane, one of my reflections reading the white paper was, you know, I mean, we can argue about whether or not it's, you know, it's got its problem right and it's got its answers right. But one of the things it seems to me that it undercooks a little bit is not participation in the labour market. You would expect that in this white paper, but the way in which the labour market is changing and what at a sort of macro level employers need, you know, this thing you read in the papers about entry level jobs kind of disappearing and being taken over by the robots whose job is in this kind of new landscape, whose job will it be to analyze the labor market and then, you know, start to adjust offers and you know, AIG towards said labor market?
Well, like most things, the answer is Skills England, and this is becoming to become a bit of a meme in the sector actually, about how whenever there's any problem flagged, Jackie Smith will start up and say this will be a priority for Skills England. So like it is becoming a little bit unsustainable, these expectations on Skills England. But Skills England have actually already started on this in their shadow form, and which is what they call government bodies that aren't quite yet fully operational, and they've already done a report. They did a report I think around over the summer on their sort of initial analysis on the labour market and skills requirements in 8 sectors that were identified in the industrial strategy for growth, and then 2 other sectors, construction and health and social care, which the government have deemed rightly to be important for growth, albeit not necessarily in the industrial strategy. There is a huge job of work to do, and Merrill combined authorities are absolutely the right place for this to happen, to unpick that on a local level and bring the right stakeholders together to do some planning, because no one's really been doing that planning on a systematic level under the current system. There's all sorts of local skills strategies, local skills improvement plans that lots of listeners will be involved in to various extents, but nobody really has been coordinating that on a national level. And again, that will be the job of Skills England. And one of the things that's been coming up in the debates in the House of Lords has been, how is Skills England going to be held to account by Parliament for its success or otherwise on delivering all of those very, very ambitious functions?
Good. Now let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Harriet Smales. I'm a sexual violence researcher and PhD student. And this week on Wonky, I've been blogging about internal collaborations, specifically how sexual violence academics and sexual violence practitioners within universities can work together to build mutually beneficial relationships and collaborations. I've spoken with 6 different universities, academics and practitioners from those universities, to give some examples of how they're doing this already, maybe also identify some barriers to that internal collaboration, and have tried to identify what some of the key features of beneficial relationships have been. For example, working on specific projects, but then keeping those connections going far past the end date of a distinct project, to, like I say, kind of hopefully build those mutually beneficial relationships and ultimately further the university's sexual violence approach.
Now, talking of postgraduates, the results of this year's postgraduate taught experience survey are out. Shane, what do we learn?
We learn that there's a higher than certainly last year, possibly ever, overall satisfaction rate among postgraduate taught students. A record number of them took part in this year's survey, 98,311, which according to a piece by Mac Marshall on the site, is about 13% of
of the cohort. So overall satisfaction has increased by 1 percentage point on last year to 84%. But there are some really interesting differences when you unpick that, when you look at different student groups. So that overall satisfaction rate was 80% for home students and was 87% for international students. And what advanced HE researchers have found is that international students, for them, the strongest correlation with overall satisfaction was around feeling prepared for a future career. And another interesting difference is comparing the satisfaction levels between students that declare a disability and students that don't declare a disability. And it's probably worth highlighting that there's been a 54% increase in postgraduate taught students with a declared disability in the last 4 years. However, that overall satisfaction rate was markedly lower in advanced HE's words at 77%, which is, you know, quite a gap. There's lots of reasons are explored in that survey, in the report. Really, really interesting stuff. And, you know, for me, I think it's quite interesting to explore why, what it is that delivers that lower satisfaction rate for home students compared to international students. You know, is there some expectations management that needs to happen in the sector? And what have international students got access to that perhaps home students don't have access to in terms of, you know, the student experience from onboarding right the way through to, you know, teaching, learning and assessment. So some really interesting stuff in there. Other sort of highlight, I guess, is that there's been a slight drop in the number of students that have considered leaving the course in this year's survey results. It was 18% last year and it was 16% this year. And one of the biggest factors, though, that students reported was leading them to consider leaving their course was balancing their studies with other commitments and financial difficulties. And for students with declared disabilities, it was health problems.
I mean, Debbie, there's all sorts of hypotheses here, aren't there? I mean, you know, one of the hypotheses is, well, you know, if you're an international student, you've spent out 20 grand on a PGT quote. It's like buying a car. You don't want to admit it's rubbish. So of course you're going to say it was brilliant. But this is, you know, this is not a population survey and it's not weighted. Isn't this just telling us that there are more international students and international students are less likely to be disabled?
Well, there are 98,000 responses. So I don't think, you know, I think it's, you know, it's a good number. In terms of, I mean, I can't, the thing that struck me was when looking at this is, and this is really no shade to Advanced HE because this is sort of how it has always been done, is that can you just compare kind of cohorts by sort of in that sort of demographic way? Can you just say international versus home and just say, well, okay, now we can draw conclusions from this? Because I think the kind of the context that we are operating in is sufficiently complex to warrant trying to kind of segment the data in a different way. And I realize this is a very technical point, but I'm not sure that knowing what international PGTs at a kind of UK level think is all that helpful. I might be quite interested in finding out whether there is a difference in the experience between international PGTs at institutions that have rapidly grown their numbers of international PGTs in the last 2 to 3 years versus those that have stayed kind of broadly stable or grown only modestly or indeed have reduced. And you know, I might be wanting to explore that. And it may be that the researchers did do some of that kind of privately and didn't find anything significant. But it's that kind of thing about you sort of say, oh, well, international PGTs think this. And then everyone says, oh, well, it's because they spend 20 grand. And you can absolutely make that case either way. You know, but by the same token, I think there's some kind of breaking down by country of origin. But that's the sort of thing that if you're a head of international and you're thinking about how to the challenge is all about kind of diversifying your recruitment portfolio, right? So you probably really want to understand that experience from perhaps by country or perhaps by kind of route in to the UK. You know, do they come via an agent? Do they apply directly to the institution, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think there's something about the extent to which surveys like this can answer the questions that we have right now, as well as kind of give us a sort of time series. And in the context of that kind of real challenge that the sector is facing right now about creating a sort of sustainable, managed, long-term solution around international recruitment, which is absolutely in that PGT space, then you're asking questions that can kind of contribute to that policy agenda, I think, is probably more useful than that broad kind of how satisfied are students, you know? I think the landscape's changing on the kind of notion of the student experience survey. this is a very well conducted, and you know, 98,000 is a very big number. And so therefore, you know, anyone who kind of wants to know at that broad level Ensemble should be absolutely looking at this report. But it also seems a little bit of a shame that there's kind of lots and lots of data there that could really help move forward some really quite live conversations that we're not seeing.
Roscoe, if you're a disabled student in higher education, today, if you email the student loans company, the turnaround time on getting a response to your email is February the 1st. Is it any wonder that disabled students are having a worse experience?
No, absolutely not. It's, I think this data shows us that institutions have got far further to travel on ensuring a consistency of experience for all of their students. I think Debbie's right to say that 98,000 responses is a lot, but it's still only around 13-14% of the postgraduate population. So there's still a significant proportion here that we're not hearing from, and I don't think many researchers would take 13% as a good response rate overall. I think Debbie's also right to kind of call out that need for a far greater interrogation of the kind of the cross sections of the data. When you're looking at it very bluntly of home versus international, black versus white, disabled versus non-disabled, it limits, I think, the extent to which you're able to kind of truly get a representative view of the student experience. Just on that kind of international versus home point, I mean, we were looking at our data at Exeter, and it's quite interesting when you look at the very large populations in the postgraduate cohort. The vast majority fall within degree apprenticeships, teacher training, or health-related programs. Their vast majority are home students. They are not on campus a lot. They are embedded within employers. And so I think some of the points that come out here around kind of community, feelings of belonging, connections with other postgraduate students, it's not surprising, I think, when you kind of then look into some of the programs that these students are doing. I think, you're more likely to see international students doing kind of traditional one-year PGT taught on campus programs. And certainly from the Exeter's experience, our home students are probably a little bit more atypical.
Obviously, as we record, DK is somewhere in the south of the country looking at last year's student loans company data. And one of our sort of hypotheses going into that, which we'll confirm or deny in the show notes, is that the taking out of a postgraduate loan for home students is continuing to decline. Should that concern us, Shane?
I think it should. I think that there's clearly a conversation that's taking place around post 18 education funding, and I know that listening to some of the conversations that have been taking place about the new government's plans around a new comprehensive post 16 strategy, the government seemed to be quite keen on really clear pathways, right the way through education, not just through ages but also through stages. So I think we've got lots of lessons to learn from various loan pots across the education system. At level 3, the advanced learning loan system absolutely decimated participation by adults in further education, and we know that there's a huge question mark about the lifelong learning entitlement and the willingness for people to take out smaller loans for smaller units and modules, and that's been discussed lots and lots on this podcast. So we absolutely should be concerned that postgraduate loans, what's going on in that space, because I think it does tell us something about what people's relationship is with education and also with how much they want to invest personally going forward. And if the future is modular and if the future is lifelong, we need to have a really, really clear understanding about that relationship that individuals have between their education and their money.
And their personal investment, what they're signing up to in terms of future quasi-taxation and so on. Debbie, when you go up to UHI and you see that, they're very good at this in UHI, those posters where they sort of have those images of someone that was sort of, 14, and then, 15 years later, they're a qualified barrister or something. That sense that Shane talks about, that pathway all the way through, that is a real mess in England right now, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, that's exactly what we're talking about with the Treasury, isn't it? It's that kind of, how do you, I think there, it remains also a question about the extent to which that is solved by kind of, people in regions getting together and kind of mapping the pathways. Because of course, especially at that kind of higher.
We've got a map. Look how complicated it is.
Well, but also, I mean, it's not PGT. I think you could sort of, there, well, and actually, in a lot of in most kind of level six and above qualifications, there's a national market for some stuff, right? So if you want to, you don't just want to do any mechanical engineering PGT, you want to do the best mechanical engineering PGT, and then you got to go to the place that does that. So there's always a bit of that, and then there's lots of online provision, and of course there's the kind of younger cohort, and then the older kind of reskilling cohort. So it's not a straightforward picture. I think that some of this is probably about when you get to PGT level, there's a sort of professional qualification stuff as well, which you sort of need to do. So it's probably less about, I think you absolutely should kind of, if you're doing kind of curriculum mapping or trying to kind of describe that at the local level, you should absolutely incorporate PGT into that. I think you want to, the thing that you really want though is to think quite carefully about at the lower level about how you're thinking about preparing students for the next bit, if that's what they want to do. And I think when we get to the kind of rollout of LLE, there's a job for universities to do, again, with colleges, with employers, to really think about how you support decision making, about how you build, potentially quite a bespoke education journey. But once that becomes the responsibility of the student rather than the institution, any given institution, to kind of map that out for you, then you're in a very different kind of landscape. So that becomes quite challenging, because it becomes less of a kind of, well, this is how it is done, and a bit more of kind of, well, these are your options, and you now have to make good choices, which is obviously a hard thing to ask people to do. So yeah, we sort of collectively need to skill up in that regard.
Roscoe, obviously when we look at surveys like this, and everybody does this, I certainly did it, the first question is, well, what were the characteristics makeup of the respondents, and does that help explain, the answers, is this value added or not, all of that sort of stuff. But one of the questions I often ask myself about PGT, particularly at perhaps subject level, is, well, how posh are these people? And we have fairly good data on participation by characteristics and social class at all sorts of levels, but we don't have very good data on PGT, do we?
No, not at all. And there was a bit of money from Hefke in about 2012 or so that was started to try and ask some of those questions about, what does access and participation in the PGT landscape look like? If you've come from a low participation neighbourhood or a kind of an access background through your undergraduate programme, and you've been transformed at the undergraduate level, does that continue with you, or do your access needs change as you become a PGT student? We've still not answered that question. I see nothing from the Office for Students that's pushing institutions to actively think about access in the postgraduate world. And it's kind of a hidden bit of the landscape that I think we're missing. If we know that the international PGT landscape is going to continue to decline in the coming years, and we're going to be looking to home markets, both at undergraduate and postgraduate level, to try and replace some of that income, we need to actively have this conversation. How do we encourage access from those who may not ordinarily be seeking level 7 qualifications?
Now, every week this season, we'll be having a think about how things were and how things came to be. With City St George's Academic Registrar Mike Ratcliffe, here's the hidden history of HE.
If you were to pitch up at an English university in the middle of the 19th century and ask to see the research facilities, you would be very disappointed, because there were none. Firstly, the universities were mostly concerned with non-experimental sciences, so you wouldn't be shown to any great laboratories. There were some laboratories the students were allowed to do something in, but original research was not, even in the humanities, something that they thought was important. So much so that if you go to the work of Cardinal Newman, his very important lectures on the idea of the university, he's quite dismissive of the idea of generating new knowledge. If the object of a university was scientific and philosophical discovery, I do not see why a university should have students. He's very clear that it's not any of their business. And certainly there are plenty of examples, and Oxford does very well at coming up with these examples, of why universities shouldn't do research, they shouldn't do science, this isn't their business. Discovery of knowledge is nothing much to do with them. So one of the great reformers of the University of Oxford is Master of Balliol, Benjamin Jowett, and he's this great idea that he reforms all sorts of things at university. He's hated by some conservatives, but one of the things he's very clear on is that research is not the kind of thing that his university should be doing, because it threatened the whole tutorial and examination system, which was making Oxford into the highest of high school for boys. So for him, it was a really bad thing, and he came up with this idea, someone talking to him. Research, the master exclaimed. Research, he said, a mere excuse for idleness. It has never achieved and will never achieve results of the slightest value. So this is the head of Balliol, very clear that this is not something that should happen. Clearly, there's an ongoing movement. There's what you get is this interaction between the new universities, places like Manchester, who start to borrow the apparatus of the research university, which is developed in the US and developed from Germany, and they work out that actually useful knowledge is A, useful to the locale, but actually is generating new things. So they both do what we might think of as applied, but also basic research. So you start to get a development. Cambridge sets up the Cavendish Laboratory in 1874 and gets an extraordinary range of people who come. Nobel Prizes develop very quickly. The fundamentals of the universe are understood by people at Cambridge. This idea that we should advance knowledge is now seen as something that we should get on to do. There's an association with Lord Kelvin, who's at Glasgow University for an extraordinary amount of time. But this is a man who perfects underwater cables, who does temperature, who does all sorts of things. Polyglot of thinking about what a university should be doing, discovering things. But in other places, this is still seen as definitely a bad idea. And it only really finally gets cemented after the First World War, when the useful knowledge that universities have contributed towards the war is actually seen by both government and by society as something that is worth reflecting. And it certainly wins the argument finally in Oxford that, university research is the kind of thing that they should be doing, and they start to set up the major facilities that they have. And it really kicks on from there.
Now, finally this week, the former boss of UUK is doing what UUK types do and is asking for money. Roscoe, what's Alistair Jarvis's big idea?
Well, Alistair has picked up one of the points that was in UUK's blueprint for change, which effectively is kind of asking the government to establish a transformation fund, essentially financial support to accelerate change and efficiency in institutional operating models. It comes on the back of the welcome, but not brilliant announcement that we're going to have some increase to fees and maintenance. But when you're seeing reports come out about the financial sustainability of the sector, that more is needed. And so Alistair's piece on the site today kind of puts some more flesh on the bones of that ask for a transformation fund. He argues that, this is an opportunity for institutions to be proactive and to reach out to government on where they think they can change, rather than it being done to them. He'd quite like to see this link to the Secretary of State's five priorities for education, which were set out in her letter to heads of institution after coming into power. That they mainly kind of surround access, economic growth, the civic agenda, teaching standards, and this point of efficiency. He suggests that in exchange for time-limited funding, institutions would need to put forward business cases that effectively would kind of seek this transformation, linking it to some targets and whether or not the money would be a loan that could be converted into a grant on meeting those targets. And he gives a kind of a straw person looking at an institution looking to effectively close a set of programs while opening a new set focused on some of those skills demand areas that we were talking about earlier.
Now, Shane, this is, what's mapped out here is a very sort of, autonomous provider-led style transformation suggestion. You've been round the block in another part of the tertiary sector on perhaps a more centrally led type of transformation.
Yeah, I mean, my first thought when I read Alistair's piece was be really careful what you wish for. Obviously, gone are the days when you could ask for money without there being some kind kind of demand for something in return. But what we saw in further education, when it became very, very obvious that the sector's finances were becoming problematic to the point of colleges literally, you know, running out of cash and needing millions of pounds in government bailouts, was that the government did introduce, they didn't call it a transformation fund, but there was a restructuring regime which did have that business case attached to it that was linked to business models, was a little bit about restructuring, you know, finances and commercial debts. And this was around sort of around 2019. Then we had the insolvency regime off the back of that, where a college could go bust. And that's only been enacted three times, but that's cost the state tens of millions of pounds in lawyers, mostly. And what I think you end up with when you fast forward a few years is you then end up with legislation, white papers and so forth, which start to then put more demands from the state of what they get in return for the investment that they pump into you as institutions. And then the ONS turn around and go, well, you're public sector now. So then you can, you know, kiss goodbye to commercial borrowing and welcome in a whole host of new controls, including, by the way, on senior pay. So I'd be really, really careful on how this conversation sort of develops, and would strongly encourage people to think, you know, 5 or 6 years ahead if you want to stay out of that that ONS reclassification debate.
Debbie, ahead of, you know, this, whatever is coming, this kind of plan that we've been promised next summer, that either will be, you know, separate to, from or umbilically linked to some of the other stuff in tertiary, is there a sense that can this actually come early enough, if it was to come, to catch some of the really egregious financial problems, given the kind of slightly longer time frame the government seems to have around reform and the funding underpinning it?
Well, I think that, and we're going to say this in a bit, you know, in a bit more of a kind of bells and whistles way in a couple of weeks, because we've been doing a project about with our colleagues at Mills and Reeve about what the kind of sector's appetite for transformation is and what that might look like, is that if it's transformation is seen as a sort of response to financial sustainability problems. I mean, obviously there might be some kind of, you know, you hope that there will be some kind of long-term sustainability gains from a process of transformation. But if you're doing it just to be sustainable, then the a lot of these things won't save money in the short term. Is kind of your point. You know, the worked example that Alistair proposes, winding down 10 courses that are not really recruiting, that maybe aren't kind of meeting the needs of the local area in the way that the 10 courses that you have in mind to spin up would, that costs money. It takes a long time. There's no, you know, and ultimately you will become more long-term sustainable, but in the short term, you will absolutely not be. So I think there needs to be a kind of clear distinction between the sort of the vision for the sector that the government might have, and that kind of sense of how can it be more coordinated, how can it be more oriented to, you know, skills agendas and economic growth and all the rest of it, and what we do when an institution is in serious financial challenge, and how we kind of manage that situation, and acknowledge that one of the kind of drivers for transformation is efficiency, I suppose, but actually that the big driver needs to be impact. It needs to be about what is the sector able to achieve. And I think one of the things that really strikes me about reading Alistair's piece, and this is kind of my view, not his, but so, you know, is that, you know, the sector probably will transform if left to its own devices. you know, because at the end of the day, universities are always looking at kind of what is successful, what is recruiting, how to be more impactful, how to realise their mission in interesting ways. The problem is that while they are so focused on cost cutting and kind of managing their finances in the short term, it's just very hard to look at that longer term agenda. And so, I think it will transform, and there will be kind of conversations with lenders to support that, and there will be other sources of finance available if there's a sort of clear kind of, you know, return on investment for the future. But it will just take longer, and it might not be in the way that the government wants. So, you know, I think this is sort of throwing down the gauntlet to government and saying, look, you have the opportunity to drive some of this transformation, notwithstanding Shane's point about be careful what you wish for, and kind of shape it and put a framework around it and see it happen at pace in a way that would then perhaps start to realise results within the timeframes that you might wish it to. Versus, well, you can kind of let the sector kind of do it by itself and make kind of encouraging noises, but you might not end up quite where you wanted to be, and it'll certainly take about, you know, at least sort of 2 to 3 times as long.
Roscoe, it sort of strikes me that lots of universities right now are looking at either at module level or pathway level or campus level or program, even, you know, in some cases whole institution level, but are looking at stuff and saying, well, this isn't sustainable because when you compare the costs to the income. You know, it isn't covering it. And the cross subsidies don't stretch far enough anymore. Isn't there a point at which large chunks of perhaps quite traditional, quite elite HE have got a bunch of students that want to study that stuff, a bunch of institutions that would like to put it on for more money? And at some point, a bit like we see very, you know, quite substantially in the health service, you know, the demands are made for people to be able to opt out of a public funding loan system, which doesn't cover the costs of the stuff that people want to study in the way they want to study it.
I think it speaks exactly to Debbie's point around if you leave the sector to it, it will find a way to do it itself. I mean, we know that institutions are actively restructuring, transforming, going through efficiency exercises right now. You know, I was on a call with my counterparts from other Russell Group institutions recently, and the amount of us that are undertaking major curricular transformation is astronomical. Will anybody kind of remove themselves? I think maybe, but I think you've got to be a very particular kind of institution to do that. You've got to be very certain that you're going to find a way through it. And I think I don't think many institutions will probably have the appetite to completely step away from the arm of government that, you know, is thrown slightly around us at the moment.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to go in deep on anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything going on in UKHE, do click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Shane, Roscoe, Debbie, Michael Salmon, who makes the show happen. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.